Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 14,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Despite some heavy opposition from many of Florida's federal and state lawmakers, the possible end of the offshore drilling ban has its fans, at least from the oil and natural gas industry.
So long as the vast majority of offshore areas remain off limits, the U.S. will never realize the full economic and security potential of our energy resources. That's why we commend this administration and Congress.
Also tonight, nearly 7 years after the BP oil spill, lawmakers are working out a plan for sending settlement money to impacted communities.
Probably one of the biggest, most significant things we could have happen toward recovery, both economically and environmentally.
We'll also get the latest on all the back and forth regarding the state budget, a possible ban on Florida sanctuary cities, and a good news, not so good news for state workers. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the final week of this year's lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. The American Petroleum Institute is praising President Donald Trump's latest move to open up the eastern Gulf of Mexico to offshore drilling. But more than half of Florida's congressional delegation stands opposed. And as Jim Ash reports, the timing of Trump's latest executive orders is a little bit awkward.
Late Friday, the White House announced Trump was ordering his Interior Secretary to redraw the nation's five-year energy plan to include vast new areas of the Eastern Gulf, as well as the Atlantic and Arctic oceans. By Monday, API Director Eric Melito was singing Trump's praises in a media conference call.
Developing our abundant offshore energy resources is a critical part of a robust, forward-looking energy policy that will secure our nation's future energy and strengthen the U.S. energy renaissance.
Drilling platforms won't sprout on the horizon overnight, Melito said. But millions of offshore acres could be available by 2022, when a ban on drilling within 125 miles of the Florida coast is set to expire. Melito said the U.S. domestic energy production boom saved the average motorist $550 at the pump in 2015, and the average homeowner $1,300 in lower power bills. And Melito even suggested that offshore drilling is good for the environment.
Leading the world in reduction of carbon emissions, which have reached 30-year lows in the power sector due primarily to clean-burning natural gas, demonstrates that energy security and environmental progress are not contradictory goals.
But 17 members of the Florida congressional delegation, including five Republicans, disagree. Led by U.S. Senator Bill Nelson, they fired off a letter to Trump warning that his move was threatening Florida's tourism industry. Environment Florida State Director Jennifer Rubiello echoes their concerns.
Our coasts and oceans here in Florida are home to stunning wildlife, gorgeous beaches, and we have a really robust tourism economy. And these are all things that stand to lose from more offshore drilling.
Even earlier this week, Trump reversed stricter safety standards for offshore drilling equipment that his predecessor issued in the wake of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. 7 years later, Florida lawmakers are still fighting over how to divvy up the state's share of a nearly $5 billion payment BP agreed to give five affected states. Here's Panama City Republican Senator George Gaynor selling his Triumph Gulf Coast legislation to the Commerce and Tourism Committee.
I was a county commissioner, too, when the oil spill happened, and I wondered back then, you know, if it'd ever be settled and if it would be settled to the benefit of the people that were damaged in Northwest Florida. Certainly everybody from Alachua County to Escambia County was damaged.
Environmental groups have been on high alert since Trump issued the drilling order, says Audubon of Florida Executive Director Eric Draper.
Our concern would be that this is a beginning of an effort to undo the law that, frankly, Senator Nelson put into place that keeps a 125-mile limit on drilling off our Gulf Coast.
Trump insists that offshore drilling can be done safely, but Draper notes that the new executive orders won't lead to drilling platforms off Mar-a-Lago, Trump's beloved Palm Beach summer White House. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
A measure to send $300 million to help eight Panhandle counties recover following the Deepwater Horizon oil spill appears to be nearing a final hurdle to pass this legislative session. We get more on that story from Regan McCarthy.
The BP oil spill of 2010 dumped barrels and barrels of oil into the Gulf over the course of months. It wrought havoc on the economy and environment in Florida's Panhandle, and the effects were lasting. 4 years after the spill, scientists continued to find balls of oil and tar washing up on what were once pristine beaches. Now, nearly 7 years later, lawmakers are finalizing a plan for distributing settlement money from the spill.
The oil spill is one of the most significant issues we've had happen in this state, maybe ever, one of the most tragic.
That's Pensacola Republican Representative Clay Ingram. He says that settlement money is needed to help those impacted by the spill rebuild.
The damage money coming to us from BP is probably one of the biggest, most significant things we could have happen toward recovery, both economically and environmentally.
The plan is to send 75% of the money coming to the state from the BP oil spill settlement to the eight counties most impacted by the spill. Those counties are Bay, Escambia, Franklin, Gulf, Okaloosa, Santa Rosa, Wakulla, and Walton. In 2013, the legislature created Triumph Gulf Coast, Inc. Pensacola Republican Senator Doug Broxson says the idea is to use that corporation to help select projects and dole out funding. But he says the move will include partnership from local governments.
You're going to see a great effort by every county, including county commissioners, city council, every elected body that will be involved in making sure that this money is being spent to build our economy.
The Senate plan contains a provision that would ensure each of the eight counties gets at least 5% of the funds in the first year and 4% in subsequent years, in order to ensure smaller or more rural counties aren't left out of the mix. A House plan would have directed at least 6% of the funds to each county. That small difference has been a sticking point between the two chambers in the past, but on the Senate floor Monday, Panama City Republican George Gaynor said all parties had agreed to the Senate numbers. The full Senate approved the measure, sending it back to the House for another look. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Protesters gathered across the country on Saturday to push for government action on climate change. South Florida protest sites included North Palm Beach, Miami, and Mar-a-Lago. We hear from WLRN's Kate Stein that a George English Park in Fort Lauderdale worries about equity intersected with concern for the environment.
Richard Whitecloud is with Sea Turtle Oversight and Protection, a rescue and conservation group based in Fort Lauderdale. He says climate change and sea level rise are destroying turtle nesting sites on Florida's coasts. But that's not the only reason he was protesting.
So much of the population of the state of Florida lives within 25 miles of the coastline. And over the next coming decades, we're going to see massive sea level rise and saltwater intrusion, not only into our urban areas, but also into our freshwater aquifers.
Emma Collum is executive director for the Florida chapter of the Women's March, a group that led an international protest the day after President Trump was elected. Collum lives in Fort Lauderdale and says she's seen how rising seas will have a huge impact on lower-income South Floridians.
We're looking at a very significant increase in flood insurance for the residents in Fort Lauderdale. That disproportionately impacts those individuals in communities who live on these flood lines who can simply not afford to bear the economic burden of living in this community.
This is the second national protest in a series of at least three. Last weekend was the March for Science. Next weekend is a protest for workers' and immigrants' rights. I'm Kate Stein in Fort Lauderdale.
A state appeals court will hear arguments June 13th in a dispute that started after Florida State University included gun-related information in a 2015 football game day guide for fans. The First District Court of Appeal last week agreed to hear the case filed by the Second Amendment group Florida Carry, according to an online docket. Florida Carry is challenging a ruling last year by Leon County Circuit Judge Charles Dodson in favor of the university. Florida Carry and Becca Hargrove, who's executive director of Florida Students for Concealed Carry, filed the lawsuit because the FSU Football Game Day Plan 2015, a 28-page information packet sent out by campus police, advised visitors that firearms could not be stored in vehicles parked on campus. Florida Carry and Hargrove argued the guide failed to follow a 2013 appeals court ruling that said the University of North Florida could not prevent firearms from being stowed in cars. After Florida Carry filed the lawsuit, FSU updated the guide and acknowledged the information hadn't been changed earlier to reflect the 2013 ruling. Dodson and May ruled against Florida Carry, saying the issue became moot when FSU updated the guide. Still to come on Capitol Report, as budget talks come down to the wire, lawmakers are brushing off criticism for bargaining over spending priorities in secret.
No bill in this process exists in isolation. It really doesn't.
Legislation banning sanctuary policies has passed the Florida House, but critics like Democratic Representative Evan Jenny say it raises serious constitutional concerns.
You are forcing locals to act as agents of the federal government. It is against the Constitution. That is what we are violating with this bill.
And while Florida's state workers may rejoice over the prospect of a long-awaited raise in the proposed state budget, they may not be so happy about changes to the state pension plan and employee share of health care coverage.
I have a problem with it, but all that being said, I think I'm going to swallow the apple because there's some candy around it.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
The full Florida Senate is preparing to take up a modified version of the House's tax cut proposal. But Nick Evans reports a property tax measure may be more important to House leaders.
House and Senate leaders are racing to lock in last-minute deals ahead of a budget deadline. The horse trading touches areas of the budget funding the environment, education, and health care, just to name a few. And it shouldn't come as a surprise in a GOP-controlled body, one of the biggest topics is tax cuts.
It reduces the state sales tax rate on rental of commercial real estate from 6% to 5.28% or 5.8%, which is something that we've been working on, and hopefully this gets us the start of continuing down that path. Provides a 3-day.
That's Lakeland Republican Kelly Stargell introducing the Senate's take on a raft of reductions from the House. But while the package maintains popular elements, the reduction in commercial lease taxes is a fraction of the one approved in the House. Clearwater Republican Jack Latvala explains the overall package is far smaller than the House's almost $300 million in cuts.
We had commercial lease, we had a 3-day tax holiday, we had Senator Pasadomo's bill on feminine products, we had a couple of small ones, so I think all together that's about $75 or $80 million.
The measure passed its only Senate committee without debate. But the tax package is just one element in a much broader series of trade-offs House and Senate leaders are settling behind the scenes. And in terms of priorities, the House appears far more interested in property taxes.
Home ownership across our state is getting lower and lower and lower.
St. Cloud Republican Representative Mike LaRosa is backing an additional $25,000 homestead exemption.
This tax cut gives them an option to make that reality a possibility. Owning a home is the American dream. It always has been. I hope that it always will be.
House Speaker Richard Corcoran has been promising the exemption since before session began. But there's one very important wrinkle. The idea has to go to the voters, and it needs the approval of 3/5 of the members in each chamber to get there. In the Senate, that means 24 yeas. But with one Republican resigning amid controversy and another at home recovering from cancer, Senate President Joe Negron only has 23 GOP members. With the vote in doubt, the blog Florida Politics reported Corcoran held a gaming compact hostage. Monday, Bradenton Republican Bill Galvano addressed the issue.
I know there have been some intimations, if you will, that maybe the process wasn't where it should have been, or maybe that this is really just a means to an end, part of a bigger picture, a part of a necessary step in order to achieve session goals.
But he seems to chalk it up as par for the course.
No bill in this process exists in isolation. It really doesn't. What session have we been through that doesn't result at the end of the day with a mosaic of ideas and intentions that we all as the members stitch together?
In the end, supporters cobbled together more than enough votes to get the House its win. Latvala, the Republican budget chief, actually voted against the idea, but 7 Democrats came across the aisle. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Legislation banning so-called sanctuary policies has passed the Florida House, but it's unclear whether the Senate will advance the bill in the final week. We get more on that story from Sarah Mueller.
Legislation by Yalaha Republican Representative Larry Metz suspends state funding to local governments that don't comply with federal immigration officials. But critics say the bill raises serious constitutional concerns. Democratic Representative Evan Jenny says the measure doesn't define what a sanctuary policy is. He adds only the federal government can regulate immigration laws under the U.S. Constitution.
You are forcing locals to act as agents of the federal government. It is against the Constitution. That is what we are violating with this bill.
Metz's bill requires local governments to repeal any policy or custom that doesn't report undocumented people to the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE. Elected officials who don't report illegal immigrants could lose their office. The measure also requires law enforcement officials to detain undocumented people for up to 48 hours so ICE agents can take them into custody after they would normally be released from jail. Francesca Menes with the Florida Immigration Coalition says the legislation violates the civil rights of Floridians. The U.S. Constitution gives due process rights to people in the U.S., including people here unlawfully. That means law enforcement officers have to have probable cause and a judicial warrant to hold someone in custody. Immigration officers send requests, called detainers, to sheriffs and jails asking them to hold someone in custody after their local criminal cases are closed. Menes says local governments have been sued for illegally detaining people, including U.S. citizens.
With a bill like Metz's bill, which is one of the things I stressed over and over in committee meetings, is that Metz is trying to legalize something that the courts have said is not legal. You're trying to force localities to do something that they are not required to do by the federal government, which is why it's called a request.
Ronnie Chavez Aguilar, a naturalized citizen, filed a lawsuit in late March saying he was illegally held by ICE for 18 days without access to a lawyer or a judge. Kentucky law enforcement allegedly detained him for ICE after he served a short stint in jail on drug charges. It's illegal for immigration officials to hold U.S. citizens, but Menes says this happens frequently.
So you just have an agent who has no legal background, no legal understanding, and just checking a box that says, yeah, I believe that there's probable cause. No judge is involved in the process.
But Representative Larry Metz says his legislation makes sure local governments help federal immigration officials deport undocumented criminals.
I am very well aware of the great contributions that immigrants make to our country, but we have to maintain the fidelity of our legal immigration system and channel people into that system so that we have knowledge of who's coming here, what their background is, what their contributions will be if they're allowed to come here.
Similar legislation by Florida Senator Aaron Bean has stalled in committee. The Senate could choose to take up the House legislation, but time is running out and most state lawmakers are focused on the budget. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Well, let's get off the legislative floor for a moment and get back into some good old-fashioned power politics. Setting up a primary battle against fellow lawmaker Denise Grimsley, State Representative Matt Caldwell announced today he will run for Agriculture Commissioner next year. The announcement wasn't really a surprise, though. Caldwell, a Republican from North Fort Myers, has raised hundreds of thousands of dollars in recent months for a political committee that could play an important role in his campaign. But it formally sets the stage for a primary race against Grimsley, who is also a Republican. She's from Sebring, with both candidates touting their long roots in the state and ties to the agriculture industry. Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, who now has the job, cannot run again for the cabinet post next year because of term limits. He's widely expected to try to succeed outgoing Governor Rick Scott. Voters also will elect a new attorney general to replace term-limited incumbent Pam Bondi. While it remains unclear whether a sitting state chief financial officer will be on the ballot, CFO Jeff Atwater is leaving office after the ongoing legislative session, and it's not clear who will be appointed by Scott to fill out Atwater's term and whether that person will run for election in 2018. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, state employees will be getting a pay raise this year under a proposal now heading to the Senate floor. But as Sasha Cordner reports, it's tied to a controversial pension reform issue and health insurance reform package, which is backed by the House.
In the Senate's original bill, Ocala Republican Dennis Baxley, the main sponsor, says it included a benefit for firefighters who contract certain types of cancers due to their job. That's still included in the new proposal.
Multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, prostate cancer, or testicular cancer.
It still contains a controversial provision criticized by many union groups. If new employees don't make a retirement choice within a certain period of time, they would automatically default into the investment plan, a 401k-style plan, and the less popular retirement option for employees. Today, public employees are defaulted into the traditional pension plan. That's one of the House's biggest priorities, and to get more senators on board, there's now a new change to the pension reform package. Sebring Republican Senator Denise Grimsley says new hires would get a longer time period to choose their retirement option, and it also includes a carve-out for the default change.
It extends the election period from 6 months to 9 months for all new hires. The new hires filling positions in the special risk class will continue to default to the pension plan.
The newly expanded bill also incorporates a proposal to create a new state health insurance program based on a four-tier system from platinum level to bronze. It will take effect in 2020 and has an actuarial study tied to it to look at the savings and cost.
Some younger employees that don't have as many medical needs can pick a plan with a higher deductible or less benefits, and they can pay less for it. So they put more money in their pocket. As they, you know, proceed as state employees and need more medical benefits, or as they get a family, or as they have kids and their needs change, they can change to one of the other levels.
That's Senate Budget Chairman Jack Latvala, whose biggest priority also made it into the pension reform bill, pay raises.
Includes a pay increase for every state employee in Florida except legislators.
Those making less than $40,000 a year will receive a $1,400 increase, while those making more than $40,000 will receive a $1,000 pay hike. Excluding the pay raises, there's normally not been an appetite in the Senate for pension reform, which Tallahassee Democrat Bill Monfort pointed out during the bill's last committee hearing in the Senate.
We've been dealing with this issue, retirement and insurance, literally for 5 or 6 years. It seems to have been an interest in the House, and it gets to the Senate and doesn't go anywhere. And all of a sudden now, we've got a pay raise wrapped up with retirement, with insurance. So that raises questions in my mind as to why are we doing it this way.
Senate Democratic Leader Oscar Brainin was also not too happy about either the pension reform proposal or the insurance changes added to the pay raises.
I have a problem with it, but all that being said, I think I'm going to swallow the apple because there's some candy around it.
While Grimsley calls it, quote, a comprehensive benefit pay package, Latvala also adds,
it's part of an agreement to make sure that everything relating to our state employees, both what we want in the Senate and what the House wants, is in one package. So it either succeeds together or it fails together.
Union groups continue to express frustration over the default provision, saying the investment plan is the riskier plan for employees. And while bill proponents say new employees can still make a one-time choice to switch to the pension plan, opponents like United Faculty of Florida's Marshall Ogletree says it's not much of a choice because they have to buy back into the plan.
Pretty expensive. That can be cost prohibitive.
Police and firefighter union groups previously opposed to the bill have now signed off on the proposal. But Florida Education Association's Linda Russell, who likes the pay raises, says it's easy to see why.
We've exempted public safety workers out of this. And I think it is a recognition that the investment plan is a far inferior plan. But I think we've also exempted them because we recognize the fact that our communities need career police and career firefighters. There's no question. And they need to be able to retire with dignity. We still believe that our communities need career teachers as well.
Still, the controversial measure received unanimous support in the Senate Appropriations Committee. And following the meeting's end Monday, Latvala expressed his irritation over the opposing union groups.
It irritates me greatly that some of those people who make their living as union organizers trying to stir up, you know, their members are trying to make something bad out of it.
And with less than a week left in the legislative session, the comprehensive bill is slated for a floor vote this week. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Kortner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us every weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 14,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.